Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. My guests this week are Tom Verisco, creator of Jackson Squared, poet Brad Richard, whose new collection is Butcher Sugar, and novelist Summer Wood, author of Raising Record. Tom Verisco owns the graphic design firm Tom Verisco Designs, and he creates gorgeous websites, brands, and logos. He teaches graphic design at Loyola University, and in addition to all that, he creates some of the most beautiful printed items you will ever see. Perhaps you've seen Desire, that gorgeous periodical of writing and design. A new one, devoted to City Park, comes out soon. Or maybe you remember Spoiled, The Refrigerators of New Orleans, that little book of photographs that celebrated the messages of defiance and black humor we all left on the fridges at our curb post-Katrina. Next came Signs of New Orleans, about our idiosyncratic signage. And now we have Jackson Squared, The Heart of the Quarter, with the subtitle, In Words and Pictures, Mostly Pictures. Welcome to The Reading Life, Tom.
Well, thanks. It's nice to see you again, Susan. That's a great intro. Thanks.
Well, this book grew out of your own time in Jackson Square, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. I lived on Bourbon Street a long time ago for about 9 years, and it was on Bourbon near St. Anne. And so, I mean, every day I would find myself in Jackson Square. And I never thought I'd do a book on it then. And at that time, there were no tarot card readers or psychics in the square. I would meet people there all the time, you know, friends who never lived in the neighborhood. And I just thought, you know, it was a nice place to be. I didn't think we were in the middle of history at the time. And then in 2004, I was asked to do a calendar book, and I decided to do it on Jackson Square. I had moved out of the quarter at that point. And I did this book, and in 2005 it came out. And I thought at the time, there's probably something in this calendar book that could be something else, whether it would be postcards or maybe a book. But I just kind of put it off. And I do think that one thing that Katrina did with a lot of us was taught us that if you want to do something, you should actually do it, because you never know what will happen next day. And I started thinking about possibly doing that book, but I put it aside, did a couple of other things before it. And then I came back to it about 2 years ago. I was in the square shooting some photographs just for the fun of it. And I thought, this is it. I should really do a book about this, but I didn't know what to title it. And oddly enough, my wife and I went to New York to see this play with music called Bloody, Bloody Andrew Jackson. Uh-huh. And it actually is quite funny. It's a broad satire on Andrew Jackson, and it was really enjoyable. And we walked out, and I thought, Jackson Squared, because there's more to him than what you think. I mean, he's a very complicated, bloody guy. And I thought, well, Jackson Square itself is more complicated, too. It seems like this simple one-square block where everyone walks through and sits, it seems, who visits here. And I thought, well, okay, that's it. I have to start actually doing the book for real. And that's when I started taking photographs and getting good friends of mine to come in with me to do it. Will Crocker, Jackson Hill, who are the other two photographers who are terrific, and John Biganay, John Carr, Nicole Biganay Peterson, and Susan Sarver. So that was the team. And we started.
It's a pretty good team.
It's a great team.
So how long a period of time would you say is represented by these photographs?
Well, some of the photographs were taken in 2004 by Jackson Hill for this calendar book that I was designing for this local printer. And most of them, I think, were taken since Katrina, you know, right after Katrina. And then I would say like half of them have been taken in the last 2 years. The other half were spattering, you know, in 2004, 2006, 2007. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine said, so is it a year in the life of Jackson Square? I mean, it really could be that if that's what you want to think it is. I mean, it's not a definitive history of Jackson Square, but it is a year in the life if you want to think that.
Mm-hmm. There's so much vitality in these photographs. You know,
thanks.
It's so much color and liveliness. And then at the same time, there are those gorgeous, subdued photographs of the foggy days and the rainy days. What is it you like best?
First of all, I think all the photographs that Will Crocker and Jackson Hill shot are terrific. I mean, they're professional photographers. They're terrific. My favorite photographs are the ones that actually show people enjoying themselves in Jackson Square. I think people think of it as their backyard, a lot of people. I mean, there's a photograph that Will Crocker shot that's on page 4, this couple kind of doing amateur gymnastics.
I saw that.
And it's really goofy.
Yeah.
But I think it's great. And Jackson Hill shot a photograph of this woman studying the newspaper. And I thought, well, okay, she could be doing that on her porch, but every morning she goes to Jackson Square and reads the newspaper.
Not anymore.
So anyway, I just thought that was pretty charming. So maybe it is a historical record. There used to be newspapers in New Orleans. And I also like there's a wedding party photograph that I shot. It actually has Will Crocker in the photograph. And I think maybe those three are my favorite photographs because they show people enjoying themselves like in a yard. It just happens to be the green at Jackson Square.
Well, I think it's John Pigeonet who points out in that wonderful foreword that it is kind of a place where we go to perform.
That's true.
We perform for each other some of the time, and sometimes we just go and watch other people perform for us.
I think that's really true. It's obvious to say that's a place to people watch, but it really is kind of fascinating. I sat there with Will Crocker a lot of times, and we just sit for an hour, and one time there was a band that just came through. And we didn't know what it was for. And then there were people following it, and we thought, well, they must have been a wedding, but it wasn't a wedding, and we still don't know what it's for. They just went through the square. And then we actually shot a wedding and got that too. But you never know exactly what's going to happen. And I think that's kind of the fun about being there, you know? Mm-hmm.
My favorite association with it is the Stanley and Stella's shouting contest from Tennessee Williams, because that's like living craziness right there. You know what I mean?
It is pretty crazy. I think the photographs show a real calm, and there are some nighttime photographs. I think I only edited down to like 6 pages of Mardi Gras itself. Mm-hmm. I thought that was kind of too easy in a lot of ways to concentrate on Mardi Gras so much. So we have like maybe 6 pages. The fun for me was editing the pages, you know, what sequence they should take. There are a lot of pages where there is someone looking at someone else, which people do a lot over there. What we noticed, and this is, I think, something I wouldn't have noticed 10 years ago, everyone has a camera. Mm-hmm. And I mean, everyone has a cell phone, an iPhone, and people take photographs of other people all the time.
Well, I want to ask you about that. When you put together a book like this, because you have so many photographs, what is the process? I mean, does anybody ever print out everything and look at them all at once anymore? Or is it always done on a computer and always done on a screen? Or are you thinking about some of the pages have lots of photographs on them and some of them have those facing spreads like you're talking about? So how does that work for you? Because it's so lovely. It feels seamless, you know.
Thank you very much. I mean, I don't sound too pretentious about the artistic process, but here we go. There is a plan here. First of all, we had a lot of photographs, and Will and Jackson did a terrific job. So it was difficult, to say the least, to try to figure out how to get 100 pages. You know, but the goal was to get 100 pages. I mean, it is a piece of commerce as well. And so it's a square book that had to be a certain amount of pages for us to be able to produce it. And yeah, it starts in a camera, goes into a computer, but I printed out every one of the photographs and put them on the floor. And then I would put photographs next to each other to see which ones worked the best. You know, I happen to love sequences. And then after I got the whole book laid out as just one photograph facing another photograph, I thought it would be great to have some pages that had multiple squares. So there are, I think, 3 instances where there are multiple photographs, but they're all squares. Because really, it was tough to decide. I mean, that's the reason. Mm-hmm. So it happens 3 times during the book. But yeah, it's just like what looks good next to each other, you know? And there's a story within a story, like people looking at other people. And there's a section where all the details show up, too, near the front of the book. And then at the end, there are nighttime photographs. And then there's early morning. And then there are the final 2 shots, which I think are funny. And we tried to keep it kind of light. I mean,
right.
It's a fun place. So I think it's a great place. It's crazy. You know, I really like it.
We value our craziness here. Well, you can meet Tom Verisco and the gang behind Jackson Squared when they sign the book Thursday, November 8th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you. This is great.
Ghosts on the streets today. Doorways of Jackson Square and tinsel and tap shoes and Mardi Gras beads in her hair and down to the graveyard she wrung out her hands as if he will meet her all day she stands. So don't leave me, and I know you're justified. So don't leave me, 'cause a part of you in me dies.
It's a pleasure to welcome Brad Richard back to The Reading Life. Last time he was here, we talked about his book of poems, Motion Studies, and now he's back with a new collection, Butcher's Sugar. In his day job, Brad is chair of the creative writing program at Lusher Charter High School. Welcome to The Reading Life, Brad.
Thanks for having me back, Susan.
Tell us a little bit about the title of this new collection, Butcher's Sugar.
This title just sort of came out while I was working on this body of work, and I didn't have anything specific that I was attaching it to, but something about the contradiction in those two words going together. And the poem that it comes from, my friend Ed Skoog read it and said, that whole poem is nothing but a collection of good titles. So,
well, there you go. Yeah. Well, why don't you read us the title poem?
All right. Butcher's Sugar. Beyond the candied peristyle and sticky portals of the body, beyond the cavernous boudoir, rank with the carcass of mystery, in a lowland of swollen cane chafed by the slutty wind, whatever it was that sweetened one's knowledge of the body, however the epicure discerned between fit meat and foul, eat. Too late to say you're hungry, but not for this.
You're such a good reader. I always love listening to you.
Thank you.
Even when the poem is really dark. Now, a lot of these poems are about boys and how vulnerable young boys are on the edge of everything. What was it like for you to recover some of the things you wrote about yourself? They're very personal, your young life.
I had avoided writing poems that were very personal for quite a long time. So when I finished my first book, Habitations, and I turned to working on this material, and I should mention a lot of this material actually came before Motion Studies.
Wow.
I was consciously trying to do something different, and it was uncomfortable at first. So that's part of why I use some indirect things sometimes to get at it, like mythology, using the voices of other characters besides just myself.
And the other thing that comes home is how vulnerable boys are. And two of the most powerful poems in this collection are about violence against young men. So I wonder if you'd talk about those a bit.
Those were very difficult poems to write. So when I started working on this, and I was starting to work on poems about my own experience and thinking about the experience of other young men, particularly young gay men, it was just kind of inescapable how much either violence or the threat of violence was a part of that experience. And I started writing these poems in the mid-90s, so there were some pretty stark cases that got a lot of national attention. The one that I write the most extensively about in the book, whose title I can't say, I found that story in Vanity Fair. And that was absolutely horrifying, the murder of Nicholas West. That poem, I read the article, I wrote a draft of it, I put it away, and then about a year later, I pulled it out again, and I really did not want to finish writing it, but I had to.
Mm-hmm.
It was a kind of act of witness
right.
to do it.
And that's the way it reads. I mean, that's the source of its real power, I think. And then you drew, it's hard to call it inspiration, from John Wayne Gacy.
Yes. There's something about Gacy's case that's so outlandish that I could at least use a playful form like the villanelle to deal with that. And that kind of helped me to cope with otherwise material that can't be coped with.
So why don't you read The House That Jack Built for us?
All right. The House That Jack Built. Sometimes he thinks he cannot bear the smell wafting through the heat ducts from the basement, earthbound odor of boys he sent to hell. Ghosts cloud his TV screen, and he can't tell how they got there. Each channel shows him torments he sometimes thinks he cannot bear. The smell has seeped into his closet. A charnel swell fills his shirts and pants. Lysol's no effacement of the earthbound odor of boys he sent to hell. It's even in the attic. If I fell and died now, I'd suffer no abasement, he sometimes thinks. He cannot bear the smell. It taints his steak and green beans, makes him ill. Night's worst, some sense recalling what a face meant. That earthbound odor of boys he sent to hell, sighs from his pillows, casts its strangled spell on dreams his waking covers like cement. Sometimes he can't even bear his own smell. Earthbound odor of boys he sent to hell.
Dark.
Yeah.
Went to some dark places with us. But then you drew also on such classical frameworks for so much of this. You know, you have all these figures, Ganymede, Pantheus.
Hermes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had always loved that material, but boy, once I zoomed in on this project, it was like all of those particular male archetypes mm-hmm. just came at me. And it's like, okay, time to deal with me now. So it was great fun. I had so much fun doing research, particularly on Hermes, for all of that material. And it, yeah.
Which will resonate with New Orleanians, of course.
Yes,
Hermes,
indeed.
You know?
So.
Now, last, where did this collection take you as a writer? Do you feel that you're in a different place now having written these poems?
Well, interestingly, this book, even mm-hmm. though it is my third collection to come out,
right.
was actually the second one in order of composition. So I think writing these extremely personal poems allowed me to deal with the material in motion studies in a much more intimate and personal way than I think I could have figured out how to do otherwise. Mm-hmm. And, you know, doing the poems that are sort of acts of witness in this book and in motion studies has kind of opened up other kinds of material for me too now. So I'm trying to work on more poems about New Orleans.
Great.
Right now. So.
Oh, I can't wait. We've been talking with Brad Richard, whose new collection is Butcher's Sugar. You can meet Brad November 9th at 7 p.m. at McEwen's Books and Difficult Music. Thanks, Brad.
Thank you, Susan.
And congratulations.
Thanks very much.
Beauty will destroy our mind. Spare the gory details. Give them gift wrap.
Wood is a writer who's new to New Orleans. She's the author of two novels. Arroyo was published in 2002, and in 2007, she received the Gift of Freedom Award from a Room of Her Own foundation, which supported her most recent book, Raising Wrecker. That novel's new in paperback and has just been named the 2012 winner of the Willa Award, named for Willa Cather and presented by Women Writing About the West. Welcome to The Reading Life, Summer.
It's a pleasure to be here, Susan. Thanks for having me.
And welcome to New Orleans, too.
Thank you.
So what brought you here? Why the change?
You know, it was kind of time to make a little change. You know, we've never thought of this as a permanent move. We wanted to just sort of do something different. Our kids are all grown, and it was time to kind of take off and have a little adventure. And that lined up with the opportunity that I had to come to UNO and write with the writers here. And so my friend Barb Johnson, who is a fabulous writer, told me about the wonderful scene here, and I wanted to come and check it out.
You know, Raising Wrecker is a wonderful way to introduce yourself to our community. I love this novel about a boy who needs a family and finds one in this unlikely group of people coming together in the woods north of San Francisco. Tell us about the origin of Raising Wrecker. It's such a great name.
Oh, thank you. You know, it's funny because for this novel, really, the name Wrecker came to me just kind of out of the blue. And I thought, that's an odd thing for a person to be called. Mm-hmm. And then I just disregarded it for a good long time. But I think that the whole novel grew out of an experience that my family and I had several years ago. We became foster parents. My partner and I have three sons. We were living in a tiny town north of Taos at the time. And there were so many kids who were in foster care. And we thought that we could provide respite or emergency care for an evening or a weekend for a kid who needed a place to live. We had so many kids running in and out of the house anyway, it didn't seem like it would be much of a deal. And so we took the training and signed up for that. And then we got our first call, and the social worker asked us if we would take four little brothers, and the oldest was four. And we thought that she was joking. We thought this was like a hazing kind of thing that they do for new foster parents. But no, she said that if we couldn't take them, that they would split the boys up and they would go to different families. And we really thought hard about it and decided that it was the one thing that we would not want to have happen to our kids, to have them split up. And mm-hmm. so we decided to give it a shot. And so for a couple of months, we had these four beautiful little boys living with us, and we got to know them, and we got to know their parents. And I think that experience really drove home for me what it must feel like viscerally to be a child who's separated from his parents, or to be a mom who's lost her son. And trying to come to terms with that experience, I think, was what led me to write Wrecker, mm-hmm. Raising Wrecker.
And another lovely thing in Raising Wrecker is this whole idea of the family you create and the family you choose, and that children can bring adults together in that wonderful configuration. I want you to talk a little bit about these characters, these misfits who rise up for him.
That's the pleasure of writing, is that these new people kind of walk into your life. You know, if you ask me about any one of them, I'll tell you, oh, that's my favorite, and mm-hmm. that's my favorite. But one of the things that I loved, too, especially in this book, was coming to love difficult characters because of the love that other characters have for them. So there's a character named Willow in the book who is perfect. She's just one of those women who can do everything and do it well and is beautiful and well-spoken and tremendously accomplished, and that's kind of off-putting for me. But the character of Len, who is Wrecker's uncle, who goes and collects him mm-hmm. from San Francisco and brings him up and finds that he can't take care of him by himself, and who turns to the women at Beau Farm, the neighbors, for help. When he falls in love with Willow, I really got a chance to understand the virtues that Willow has and to see her vulnerabilities. And I think that's one great thing that fiction does, is it doesn't just show you how great people are. It shows you how vulnerable we all are. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I love them and all of the characters.
Now, one of the things that fascinates me is that both you and Barb Johnson have won this terrific Gift of Freedom Award from the A Room of Her Own Foundation. What kind of difference did that make to you in your life? What happened when that came along?
You know, it is an incredible, incredible gift. I am tremendously grateful to A Room of Her Own Foundation collectively, and to each woman who really runs that and has made that happen, Darlene Bassett in particular, who is the founder, and everyone who's contributed to that. Because what it is it's an award that says, we have faith in women's voices. We have faith in your work. We don't care about your past accomplishments. We don't care about the letters after your name. We don't care about any of these things. We care about your commitment to your project and the story that you have to tell. And because we care about that so much, we're going to give you this big hunk of money, which means you don't have to work. And I think for Barb and I both, that's been a tremendous thing to have the time to devote completely to writing and to get the books done.
And I understand your mother is a writer, too.
This is true. She's a wonderful writer. She's written a book called How to Grow Younger. Mm-hmm. And she's really taught me what a difference it makes if you believe in what you're doing and how to let that power you forward in the world.
That's a wonderful gift. Mm-hmm. It is. And also, your sister, Harper, contributed
yes.
these illustrations to this beautiful paperback.
She's a tremendous painter, but she just started doing botanical illustration a couple of years ago. And when Wrecker came out in hardcover, it had these marvelous drawings in hardcover by a young woman who works for Bloomsbury. And Harper took a look at them and thought, I'm going to give a shot at this, too. So when they released it as Raising Wrecker in softcover, they incorporated her drawings. And that makes me just so pleased.
They're so lovely.
Aren't they?
This is fabulous.
Yeah.
We've been talking with Summer Wood, whose new book is Raising Wrecker. You can meet Summer and get her to sign a copy of Raising Wrecker and welcome her to New Orleans Friday, November 9th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The Jewish Community Center Book Fair continues this week. Novelist Amy Efron appears at the Book Lovers Luncheon Thursday, November 8th at noon to discuss her new book, Loose Diamonds. Dan Zevin provides comic relief Saturday, November 10th at 7, talking about his book, Dan Gets a Minivan, Life at the Intersection of Dude and Dad. For ticket info, visit nojcc.org. Octavia Books operates a bookstore during the book fair. Ed and Susan Poole sign Louisiana Film History, Wednesday, November 7th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Tom Verisco, along with other contributors, signs Jackson Squared, Thursday, November 8th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Poet Dave Brinks debuts his new collection from Black Widow Press, The Secret Brain, selected poems 1995 to 2012, and reads with Megan Burns as part of 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series, Thursday, November 8th at 8 p.m. at the Goldmine Saloon. Today's guest, Summer Wood, signs Raising Wrecker, Friday, November 9th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Brad Richard, reads from Butcher's Sugar, Friday, November 9th at 7 p.m., and McEwen's Books in Difficult Music. He'll be appearing along with Carolyn Hembry, Ben Koppel, Anne-Marie Rooney, and Jeff Weiss, and Michael Alenzell. The Octavia Books Science Fiction Book Club discusses Julie Cherneda's Beholder's Eye, Saturday, November 10th at 10:30 a.m. at Octavia Books. Robin Bridges signs the Katerina Trilogy, Volume 2, The Unfailing Light, Saturday, November 10th at 5 at Octavia Books. There will be an open mic reading Sunday, November 11th at 3 p.m. at the Maple Leaf Bar. Martha H. Fitzgerald signs The Courtship of Two Doctors, Monday, November 12th at 6 p.m. at Octavia Books. Michael Alenzell reads from Errata, Tuesday, November 13th at 6 p.m. at Barrister's Gallery. The Black Widow Literary Salon features Yuri Herrera this month and takes place Monday, November 12th from 7 to 9 at Crescent City Books. Carolyn Morrow Long discusses and signs Madame LaLaurie, Mistress of the Haunted House, Tuesday, November 13th at 7 p.m. at East Bank Regional Library. That's part of Coffee and Conversation, sponsored by the library and the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. Coming up, the New Orleans Book Fair and Media Expo is set for November 17th at 725 Magazine. That's the spacious garage where the Crescent City Farmers Market takes place when it rains. For more information, check out the Facebook page. This is always a blast, so stay tuned. Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans, is the biggest event this month, starting November 28th and running through Sunday, December 2nd. Featured guests include the great Ernest Gaines, who will be honored by a special work composed by Irvin Mayfield and performed by the New Orleans Jazz Orchestra. Writers on the program include Pulitzer winners Oscar Hijuelos and Jonathan Yardley, and writers Justin Torres, Maria Rana, playwrights John Biganay and Rosary O'Neill, Peggy Sweeney McDonald, Lawrence Powell, Moira Crone, and Roger Kamenetz, Freddie Evans, Ben Sandmel, Tom Verisco, Nancy Dixon, John Shelton Reed, Michael Alenzell, Jeff Weiss, David Armand, Rich Cohen, Randy Fertel, Roy Blunt Jr., Andrew Lamb, George Bishop, Pamela Binnings-Ewan, Hal Clark, Josephine Sacabo, and Dot Wonk, Carol DeSanti, Lori Carlson, Lisa Zeidner, Adam Johnson, and Lucy Ferris. Oh, and Peter Cooley and Brad Richard. For a complete schedule and tickets, check out wordsandmusic.org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.